Hi everyone, this is Dev Propulsion Labs, our podcast about the business of developer tools. My name is Victoria Melnikova. I'm the head of new business at Evil Martians. And today I have the legend of developer tools, David Kramer, founder of Sentry. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
How are you doing today?
I am good.
Good.
I'm in the perpetual state of, as I always am, I would say.
So a founder like you, an experienced founder with decades under your belt, do you still feel like you have to work a lot?
It's interesting because like sometimes I do very little. I'm not shy about this, by the way. Sometimes I'll have weeks where I put in very few hours in terms of like hard work. And then other weeks it'll be like 60 hours or something. Recently it's been a lot more, but it kind of depends because like it's not really any different than any other person. If you have something that's like really interesting and feels high value, you kind of want to complete the project or you want to do it. And as a founder, there's like this inherent, like you can see the ROI of the thing you're doing. And so if like the thing is like, oh, I have a bunch of emails to respond to or a bunch of meetings to go to, I'm like, it's not that useful. And so I'm just not going to do those things. And so it kind of depends. But it's like, it goes through cycles. But recently it's been a lot busier. So.
And you did by choice.
Yeah, definitely by choice. I tell people at the company even that like I am still doing this truly by choice, but also like even Sentry because like I've hired the CEO and recently the CTO. And so I basically like stepped out of both roles that I am at the company because I think my equity value effectively grows faster with me at the company than without me at the company. And so I think it's one, more lucrative for me to be there, but also I've like done this most of my career at this point. So it's a little bit more than that.
Let's talk about this question of delegation because I think it's a painful moment for many founders, technical founders who are very hands-on, just like yourself, hiring a CEO, hiring a CTO, those decisions. And you kind of played both roles, right? In the trajectory of the company. What was that like? How does it feel to trust somebody else to run your business and to make technical decisions, especially for, you know, technical product like Sentry?
Yeah, it is quite complicated. I think a lot of people cannot do it for what it's worth. I think I struggle with it. And I think you got to find the right people. And it doesn't mean I agree with everything we do at the company. And I think we kind of get in healthy debates a lot of times at the highest levels about like, is this the right thing? Should we be doing something else? And I think the most important thing we have is that we all recognize we are trying to do well for the business. I think particularly, especially with the CEO and the CTO roles, because executive hiring is hard in general. I think we found people that really wanted to succeed and CTO, because the CTO in our case is effectively also driving the product. It was really important for me. I wanted somebody that was like, kind of like me, that would make similar decisions to me. I didn't want to take risk. I think we nailed that. I would say our CTO is a lot like me. They're less in the weeds, but they are much sharper in terms of academic background and things like that. And so it's hard. You kind of want to get to a point where like 90% of the decisions they make would be the decisions you would have made. And then you got to accept that some of them wouldn't be, and that's okay. And sometimes those will be better decisions. Sometimes they'll be worse. Sometimes it's neutral. Most of the time it's neutral. It doesn't matter. But it's just one of those things. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. And like, as soon as you forget about the illusion of control, because control actually is not that important most of the time, or rather the idea of a title or something being how you have control. Like I have immense control at the company. I don't need a title to have like influence. Influence is probably a better word than control. And I think as soon as you let go of that, life gets a lot easier. And I let go of that a long time ago, so.
And you're still at Sentry. You're still shipping things.
More recently, I am moves. Shipping things. Yeah. I was pretty hands-off for a long time. Like you go through these like waves. You get a lot of advice, I would say, over the years. A lot of it's wrong. And early on, at some point, everybody's like, oh, you got to hire people and let them do the stuff. That is absolutely the wrong advice for what it's worth. But it's kind of like the company gets big and you've got to do the thing that is most important for you to do that other people can't do, especially as like the sort of, there's usually somebody that like is like, it's a CEO, but it's also the CEO founder is like a specific persona. It's like the buck stops with you kind of thing. So like work has to get done. And so you're doing that. And I'm like, oh, I'd love to write code, but I have the other stuff has to happen, you know? And more recently, I've actually had time to build stuff and it's been fun. I also block off like 2/3 of my calendar. And so you just can't schedule stuff. And so it's like, it's actually there so I can like work on something or experiment with something. But I will say like, that's the ambition. It still ends up being, I can't really contribute to the main application that easily because it takes a lot more like sort of focus time than I have.
I mean, it's crazy to think. I read somewhere that Sentry is used by 4 million plus developers and like 150,000 teams are using mm-hmm. Sentry. So it's really a household name for application monitoring. It's something that I don't remember me in my career not knowing about Sentry. So it's like, it's a big yeah. deal, right?
It's a thing I'm most proud of. It's like the singular goal I've had in the company is like, it should be ever present. It should like dominate the industry, but it should do it because like, we make the right decisions. We do what's best for the customer. We don't try to cheat people or anything, build a good product. And then we make all the decisions around that to support that kind of thing. And it's at this point, it's great because it's worked. It takes a long time to get here, obviously, and it's been really good. And actually, that 4 million number, I don't know how old that is. I also don't even know how we calculate that. It's such a, it's hard to calculate those numbers, obviously. The team count is much easier, but it's basically used by everybody. It's kind of like the default, which is cool. It's like really hard to achieve that, but it's fun because we get to do like big brand marketing and stuff. And people kind of know what Sentry is. And so now we do stuff and our like current agenda is like take something that's frankly just boring. Sentry is not an interesting company and just make it fun. And so, you know, we put out like ridiculous merch and stuff like this. And yeah, it's and the billboards and whatever marketing campaigns we have is really fun.
Right now, to people who don't know, it's kind of like an acid trip. Like, I don't know how to put it differently. It's kind of like Rick and Morty
yeah.
and like dashboards.
Yeah.
Goes crazy.
The theme was, well, this started like years ago when we did our first billboard. And I'm like, I just want to do something that's like shock and awe because I think like you've got to, the goal of everything is like attention. And I'm like, well, let's just do something that's like so preposterous that it doesn't make sense. And then double down on it that it has nothing to do with Sentry. So it makes even less sense. And so it was like the first concept of this was called Sentry Can't Fix This. That was the campaign. And it was a Minotaur playing Beat Saber. And like knocking things off shelves. You couldn't really visualize it because like line art. So it didn't do the illustration, probably we could have done a better job, but it absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. And that was like the first advertising campaign we did. And the current one is, it's supposed to be the concept because the creative team tries to connect it to reality is we're like production monitoring. And you look at like, it's like dashboards and numbers and like the data is like useless most of the time. It's like, cool, you have all this stuff, but it's like, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. It's like, why do we have all this? It's just a bunch of noise. And so the campaign was like, make it make sense kind of thing. And we're just like, let's just throw like random things that are just so obscure at them. And then it just turned into like, oh, here's these like hideous face things, which we've kind of done something similar to that before. And it's just fun, you know?
Yeah, it is definitely fun. One of the things that I want to note though, with this whole AI wave, Sentry was able to stay on top of it, right? So, and internally at Evil Martians, I just want to share this. The CEO of Evil Martians, Irina, is a big fan of Seer. It's not easy to actually create something relevant, you know, in the current climate and make it work well, right? It's something that's like a really fine balance. And Sentry did this thing when it doesn't only, it's not only identifying the issues, but it's also proposing the fixes, right?
The way I always articulate Sentry is like, we just help you debug problems. It's kind of like simple. And it's like, or bugs. And bug is like a loose definition. It's like, what do we think of as a bug is like users, not developers. Cause like you talk to a developer about what's a bug and they're like, well, that's not really a bug. And they have some like annoying definition, right? And you're like, no, it's broken. It doesn't work right. And so we think of it like, it doesn't work right. That's a bug. And so the idea with Seer originally was like, well, LLMs are really good at pattern matching. You can actually simplify how you reason about bugs, or like explain them better. And so it does that pretty well, actually. Basically, you can take all this noise that is the telemetry and make it make more sense. So that's like, so it does a bunch of stuff. And then it can propose patches, basically. And that patch generation is about as good as everything is. So it works sometimes. It doesn't work other times. And our sort of hypothesis is, and the tech isn't here yet. And to be fair, like frontier models are what we're banking on here. Is like, if we could automatically, probably not like merge PRs, but if you could imagine that you have a queue of proposed fixes that are more or less correct, that's like the most trivial 10% of your bugs that you're just not going to fix because they don't matter that much, but they're easy fixes that are just ready to go. I would love that. And I would actually pay a bunch of money. I'd pay like $200 per bug fix or something. I'm like, we will have that like at some point, I think in the next year or two, but I think models have to get a little bit better before that to become like a real possibility because like no matter what you try today, it's not quite there, but you can still do some cool things today. So,
one of the things you guys did is kind of derive that value right away for customers, right? Like, yes, things don't work 100% of the time, but it's something very tangible that's already on their hands. And you yourself are very much hands-on with the new experimentation with MCPs. And can you tell us about that? Like, do you vibe code? Do you code? Do you code gen? What do you do?
Yeah. So I like building things, and I spent a lot of time just like personal projects and whatnot. And I built our MCP server. And part of this is like, I have a lot of domain expertise. So I would not consider this luck or anything. I have a pretty good sense of what is going to be useful and what isn't. Doesn't mean I know everything, but if I think something's going to be useful, it's probably going to be useful. I don't necessarily know how big it'll be. But when I saw MCP, I'm like, very clearly, this is a way for me to plug Sentry into a workflow that is very obviously valuable. And it's like, I'm sitting here in Claude Code or Cursor or something. I'm working on my application. I'm building new features, or I'm fixing bugs. Some of those bugs are in Sentry. I want to pull in that context. I could copy paste it, or I could just like copy paste a URL and have it automatically pull in the best version of everything. And I could curate the best version of everything because I know better than the customer, because I am actually the domain expert. And so I'm like, MCP lets me do that. And so I saw that, and I'm like, and they had like started doing the authentication protocol. And I'm like, this is the time when I can make this possible. And so I built that pretty quickly and prototyped it. And we've still been iterating on it and trying some new novel techniques on it. And it works unbelievably well. So spent a lot of time on that. I certainly dog food a lot of our tech and coerce a lot of our team to dog food on my personal projects as well.
Did they like it?
I think it's useful because it's a different perspective. Because when you work at Sentry, we might as well be an enterprise company. It's a very large application at a very large scale. You can't ship quickly. The consequences of breaking things are serious. The scale is serious. I have a bunch of zero user apps, effectively. Some that are super over-engineered, some that use different technology stacks. And so it gives very different perspectives. So it's useful. And some other people at work have similar things. And so I think the value is there. But yeah, and so we spend a lot of time dogfooding a lot of this stuff. But I think the other interesting challenge and you know, early stage versus late stage companies or startups even have this is like, we're not early stage. We don't take blind risks. You know, we can't be like, yeah, let's bet the world on some wacky idea that's definitely not probable, you know? And so for us, even like Sierra and the MCP is like, no, these seem plausible outcomes. These seem likely to have strategic value no matter what world it comes to be, you know, kind of thing. Versus like, take vibe coding. I'm like, if you look at, say, rewind time a little bit, because Lovable and Bolt are a little bit, we know a lot more now than when they came out. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, there's no world where we're just generating an app from like a sentence or something. It just doesn't make any sense. It's not possible. And it's much more obvious now to more people, but we would never have bet the future on that kind of thing. But as a startup, you have nothing to lose. So you can do those things. And so we have a little bit different of a strategy where we're always like, what is valuable no matter what happens kind of thing. And so that's always incremental from there. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And Sierra is the same. MCP is the same. But then also it's like, well, what do we control and what don't we control? And then how do we be defensible? And all these other little things that go in there. But to go back to your other question of like, I've not written code by hand in enough months that I've lost count, but it's 6 to 9 months at this point, exclusively via Claude Code or Cursor. Pretty effective at it at this point. A lot of times it's inefficient, but I can get a lot done now. Like the MCP server is entirely generated at this point. I wrote it by hand originally, but everything is generated, plans pretty well. And so I would consider myself probably forefront expert of how this stuff actually works in reality versus loud opinions on the internet, which there are a lot of those. So
are there tips and tricks that you can share with us as far as code gen goes, like guardrails? I don't know. What are some things that were life-changing for you in how productive you can be with it? And maybe some things that are not obvious that people are not doing and you think they should.
So I think first and foremost, like people latch onto this idea of new things way too often. Like the models, it got to a point and I think it was like Sonnet 3.5 or whatever, and then they were good enough and that was it. And they've gotten a little bit better, but it's very incremental now. And so everybody had this idea of like, oh, the new one's so much better, and everybody latches onto this new model syndrome. It stopped. It's done. Like, they are better, but like even the Codex versus pick any Claude model, it doesn't actually matter. I can use any of them and be just as effective. I can't even tell you the difference because it's so insignificant to me. Now, I am sure there's tasks that matter and don't matter. And people will go through all these like, almost like voodoo. It's like, oh, you gotta like do this and then clear your history to rituals, like have a new context window. And I'm like, doesn't actually matter most of the time. And there are probably things that are useful here and not useful here, but I can run compactions over and over and be fine. I can run new context windows and be fine. And so I think you just got to figure out the workflow. That's all it is. It's a workflow. It's which tool works best for you, which approach to this works best. I will argue that like purely agentic, I don't know if you'd call it vibe coding, because I still like, I spent a lot of time with systems engineering in terms of sort of defining how I needed to look and then going back. And if it's not like that, I sort of reprompt it over and over. I think Cursor is the best tool. I don't use it as much anymore, but I think it's the best tool to do this because you can still kind of like review it as it goes, which is a really good workflow for the real world. But again, use the best tool for you. But I think a lot of it is like you have to provide the right constraints. And I think the hardest part is you need it to basically always look up information. Like you can never just be like, ask it to do something because it doesn't know anything. And I don't know why people don't understand this. You can't train the models. Like it has no, long-term it will never memory. Be smart. Yeah. It has to have real-time information. And to get real-time information, it has to access the internet. So you always, so I'm basically, whenever I'm prompting it, I'm like, go look up the information online. Like 100% of the time, that's what I wanted to do. Like look up the latest versions, look up the docs or do the thing from the shell, you know? And so I think trying to force it to do those things is really good. And there's like simple things that most people have figured out at this point. Like definitely use planning mode if you haven't. Have it generate like specs or something because those are pretty useful. You can review and they're also like a good way to resume work and whatnot. But there's not a lot of magic. A lot of people, again, they'll come up with voodoo and stuff. It literally doesn't matter. You'll come up with similar results. You just have to have a workflow that works for you. So
my general feeling of the room right now is that the hype cycle is kind of like coming to a close. Can you second that or do you have an opinion on what's going on right now?
I kind of think so, but it's always hard to say because the image stuff is really cool right now. Like Nano Banana, what a ridiculous
Pro
name.
Nano Banana Pro.
Very yeah, good.
I love
very,
it.
Very good. It's like phenomenal. And I love it because it's like, those are things, it's pretty easy to write code. Don't get me wrong. It's pretty hard to come up with lots of images of random things and especially those kinds of things. So like what I want is things that fuel creativity and you cannot, like image generation is a creative endeavor at the end of the day. Code generation is not a creative endeavor. It kind of needs to be deterministic. And so I want to see more of that. Or like the World Labs stuff is really exciting. I don't know if you've seen that, but
no.
It, like look up World Labs. It's phenomenal, like what the tech's doing. And it basically like, I don't know how, I'm not smart enough to understand this, but it'll generate like a 3D world of an image. Very cool. And so—
Interstellar yeah, style kind of thing?
I think kind of, yeah. but like you can imagine like, if you took this and all of a sudden you could walk around in a wow, virtual world or something just from a snapshot. And so there's going to be a lot of really cool things that'll come. I love Suno. Suno is phenomenal. Pro tip. You have a significant other or family member. You want to impress them. Go to ChatGPT. Ask it for lyrics to a song. Give them the name, a bunch of funny facts that are kind of like memes almost about them or embarrassing yeah, facts. And be like, I need lyrics to a song and give it the genre of music you want. Plug that into Suno. It's phenomenal.
It's so much fun.
I kind of think the programming hype cycle, I agree, has like died down because it's like you can do a lot, but you know, it's not changed much in recent history. But it seems like there's a lot more movement elsewhere now.
I'm smiling a lot because I cannot erase this image from my head. The selfies that everybody did with the girl's body.
It girl selfie.
Oh my God, it's so funny. You should go to David's Twitter page and look it up. And the Enterprise ready hat. Shout out to Michael Greenidge. He was just on this podcast as well. It's just so funny to me.
One of the guys at Sentry over the weekend, the holiday weekend, he built like a mobile app. This is not public, probably because it would empty his bank account. You can basically take like a selfie and then like randomly generate a bunch of Nano Banana prompts. One of them is the It Girl selfie. And so that's what started it. And then you can obviously upload photos to do the same thing. So I'm just like, cool, let's go.
It's hilarious.
There's a bunch of others, obviously. Yeah. But it's you can almost like this will be the new TikTok generation. Yeah. Or not TikTok, Snapchat.
Yeah.
Like the filters and everything.
Yeah.
And it's super fun.
Yeah.
It's weird and cringe a little bit, but it's fun.
I want to go back in history, right? So Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Take us to your, like, where it's all started from, because I know that the story is not straightforward and you did not always think that you would be this founder of this super successful startup. How growing up did you find this route? Like, how did you start exploring this? How did you find the strength and maybe even like start believing in yourself that you can do something like that. And I know it has to do a lot to do with the open source. So take us through this journey.
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town, Nebraska. And I think sort of key insight, I would argue, is people sort of need to go through some kind of hardship. I think a lot about this, like I'm going to have kids hopefully soon. And I'm like, how do I force them to work at like a fast food restaurant or something? Like something, you know, like, you know, they can't just grow up and have everything handed to them. And so like, you know, I worked at Burger King when I was like 15. I picked the top, we call this detasseling. You walk through a cornfield and pick the tops off of corn stalks. It is miserable. I did this in the summer for a couple of weeks, like for a few years, awful. But I would do stuff. I had a paper route. And so I had to work for a living to some degree. Because my parents are working class. But I was also obsessed with computers. And I didn't have one because we couldn't afford it. And eventually I got one. But I think I'm also just like attracted to that, which is good. So like I lucked into something that is like fortunately a good career. But then open source is like a cool thing too. And so a little bit of maybe not right time, right place, but like right personality, right kind of opportunity that existed. Because the internet was also a lot smaller back then. The community was a lot smaller. So it was a lot easier to be known. But I really got into like the Python ecosystem way back in the day, the Django ecosystem. This is when Rails was getting its start too. And I remember looking at Rails and Django and I could not understand anything about Ruby. It was just like a foreign language to me. And Python kind of looked mostly straightforward. And I had learned PHP before. Actually, no. So I tried to learn Python and I'm like, what do I do with it? Because this was pre-Django. So there was no like web. And I learned PHP, but it was like kind of a mess. And then I learned Django after that. But I got really big in the Django ecosystem. And what I would do is I would just open source everything I built. I didn't think about it. I'm like, oh, I could just publish it on the internet. And this was like when Google Code was a thing. So it was pre-GitHub era. And I mean, I would just publish everything I built. And I don't know that it was particularly good or anything. I would just do all this stuff. And there were random extensions for Django and whatnot. And, you know, one thing led to another. And that gave me recognition. And that gave me jobs. And that gave me speaking opportunities at conferences. And I would say I was a hard worker. But I actually just like really enjoyed building things. And I enjoyed recognition. And so the reason Century is like the kind of company is because I want recognition. I have like this chip on my shoulder forever that like, and I will tell you, Arne, one of our investors like almost certainly faults me for this nonstop. Like we are entirely self-sufficient. We have never like relied on anybody to get to where we are. Like there's no partnerships, there's no nothing. And so that's always kind of been Century's like, this is like evidence that like we can do this ourselves. And we want like, it's like the proof point that like everything is because we have built it in a good way, like the right way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I always wanted this like almost like validation that we like that I was good or whatever. I don't know how you describe it, chip on the shoulder. And so open source, I think, was a way to do that because you also get these feedback loops that make it fun. But this was sort of in parallel because I was like, I think I was like 15 years old when I started learning to code. And I learned through MIRC, which is like a Windows chat client for like a defunct protocol. And it had like this really bad scripting language in it. And I was like one of these like script kiddies, if anybody knows what that is. Super fun, questionable part of the internet. I don't think I understood exactly what it was back in the day. I think I just took it for granted what it was. You know, I was just experimenting online, learning all these things. And I was into video games and all this stuff. And one thing led to another. And I got a job with a company that was basically kids my age. So it's hard to call it a real company. Where we were building like, we were basically reverse engineering World of Warcraft and building content websites out of it, which is not as complicated as it sounds. There were definitely some people we eventually hired that actually understood how to do it, where I was just like brute forcing things. But that's kind of like that sort of, it enabled me to like kickstart my career. And I don't know, it's interesting because it's one of those things where like there's a lot of people I met in this era where you could turn the hobby into like a career. And a lot of these people came from games. And there was a lot of these, like they built mods for World of Warcraft, or these days it'd be like Minecraft mods or Roblox. I think you can probably do the same thing. So there's gonna be like a generation of all this, you know. A lot of those people work in the industry now, and they're actually like, they're like senior people that like run big things. And it's all because I think they actually really enjoyed it, you know? And I would say I arguably enjoyed building the technology more than playing the games. And so I just spent a lot of time doing that as a teenager. And I also dropped out. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. One thing led to another. And I sort of moved to Germany for a period of time to work for this company, quote unquote, and then followed him to San Francisco. I think that like opened my eyes to the industry a little bit more. And I don't know, a lot of this is sort of, I think if you're ambitious, and it's not ambitious like Wall Street ambitious. It's like, I just want to like, I want to be part of this or something. And you're hardworking, things kind of work themselves out. And so I think I was that. And so like, I actually left San Francisco for a couple of years to go back to Nebraska. I was going to move to New York. And then I'm like, oh, wow, New York is really expensive. and SF was not cheap ever.
Yeah.
But SF was not New York levels expensive at the time. But I left for a couple of years, stayed in Nebraska. And I'm like, this is awful. I met one single human in Nebraska my entire life that knew how to write code. And I was near Lincoln, Nebraska, if anybody knows where that is, which there's actually like some tech now. There's a company called Huddle, which does like sports analytics or something. But they were not there at the time. And so I'm like, I got to get out of here. And so I need to like find a company that's in SF. And turns out it was easy because I had a lot of open source stuff. A lot of people in the Django ecosystem used my stuff. And so it was like that. I had a job out here and I don't know, the rest is history, I guess. But again, I think it was just lots of hard work, lots of ambition, and open source is certainly an enabler. So people a lot these days will talk about like, well, what's the, you know, why should I do work for free in open source? It's like, I don't know, set yourself apart. It's a game of attention. Like, how do you become somebody that's like of relevance when there's millions of people in the world? So, but yeah, so very, very compressed timeline. But, and then I've been working on Century for, I mean, I started full-time in 2015 and Century itself is from 2008, long time ago.
So let's talk about that. So Century started while you had a full-time job as an engineer somewhere else at Discuss.
Yeah, and that's the company I joined when I was leaving Nebraska, so.
And you worked at Dropbox, right? Mm-hmm. You worked at different companies and you had Century at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, some form of Century, the open source version, right? Or
so
was
the
it-
open source version existed when I joined Discuss and I started the commercial version when I was leaving. Actually, I think it might've been a year before I left Discuss. It was not like intended to be like a real thing. It was like, ha, I have this little side project that maybe it'll make some money. It turns out like your side project should not be like an infrastructure company. And it just like turns out to be miserable. But yeah, so that I had that at the end of Discuss and I basically built the hosting thing over a Christmas break one time. And then when I went to Dropbox, which was my gig after Discuss, I still had it there and I was there a little under 2 years. And it was just like, that was sort of peak. Everything is hitting the fan. Can't handle this. Like Dropbox was kind of going through this like big company grow up moment, which is not fun. It's like when the fun times of the startup and the interestingness becomes like politics, frankly. And I'm like, this is not me. And Century was getting really painful because it was like, I'm on call for both jobs and Century is like struggling to stay online. And I'm like, one of these has got to give. And I don't care that much about money. I like money. Money's a nice thing. I just don't optimize for it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go do Century because I can pay myself a salary now. And so, but everybody was okay with it at the time. Nobody really cared, and which is good.
So when I joined Evil Martians, I didn't actually realize how much Evil Martians create open source for the Ruby on Rails community. I didn't know. I mean, I did know the sheer amount of it, but I didn't realize the impact it has on the ecosystem, and it's a lot. And one of the things that we talk about, and not just Ruby on Rails, like PostCSS and a bunch of projects by Andrei Sitnik are also super well known. But one of the ideas that really stuck to me is, for open source to be sustainable, you need to find ways to commercialize it somehow, either through consulting or custom, you know, builds on top of it or whatever it is, right? Or open core model, whatever it is. For many technical founders, for engineers who created this open source, it's not always obvious and easy to actually monetize your project, you know, and you have to start marketing it, you have to start selling it. It's not fun. How was that process for you? Did it come naturally? Like you were just well known in Django and Python and that's just, you know, people came to you for help or how did it work?
One, I think, so product market fit, for folks who don't understand, I would define as like a set of things. It's not just like, is the product good? It's like, is the product good? Is the way it's packaged good? Is sort of the customer profile right? It's all these combinations of things. We had that by default. Like right out of the gate, it was there. Pricing and stuff was not scalable. We charged like not enough to survive, things like this. But it was there. People wanted to pay for it. We had the right business model, basically, right out of the gate. And it was just like, people wanted it to be a hosted service, right? They wanted a cloud service. didn't care about the open source. Like some people did, but they generally didn't care. We charge per error. That's great. They don't want errors, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it just worked really well. And I never really did like anything that looked like traditional sales. I never cold called people or anything. I did try to convince people to like pay me money that were like paying less or that were using like open source that were like big companies. Was not successful at it. It was very easy, but I didn't spend hard. Like it was like no time spent. It was mostly like organic. And so I think that worked really well, but very atypical because it was like what we just happened to be able to have this cloud service thing on top of it. Whereas like most open source is not that. And so that's where people struggle. Most of it is actually like there's a consulting firm or something similar that just maintains a ton of an ecosystem. And that's like, that's the reality of it, you know?
That part was easy. It came naturally, but then you wanted to, at some point when it became a real big business, you wanted to dominate the market, right? You wanted to be the one monitoring tool. And with that, you need to master enterprise sales. You need to start talking to big guys, you know, and how do you enable teams to use your project and things like that. So, or your product, how did you tackle that? Like that was already after funding or where was it in the Sentry's lifespan? How did it happen for you?
I would say we've not yet mastered enterprise sales. Our goal was always, why is a developer that we want to use us not using us? That was the singular focus. And what I mean by that was like, okay, everybody in Django defaults to Sentry. Like we were in the official documentation for a long period of time. I don't know if we still are. And if we still are, it's probably because we like contribute financially or something, whatever. Totally fine. But we were originally, because like we just did so, I'm like, it was good. It was just generally like a good, useful thing. It was open source, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, we should bring this to more developers because I want more people to use our stuff because our stuff is really good. It was just out of a desire for adoption. Like what, again, for whatever reason that is, but I just wanted more people to use it. And this is when it was just open source, no cloud service or anything. And so the way I always approach this, it was like, not, oh, I want Wells Fargo to use it. I'm like, oh, I want PHP, Ruby. And I would always look at it and I'm like, where are the developers that are like me at? And that'd be like Rails people, or these days it'd be like Laravel people. It was not, oh, Java people or .NET people. In fact, it is still not Java people or .NET people. It is still like, okay, we're all the modern, like sort of, if you went to Y Combinator, what programming languages are they using? What frameworks are they using? That's who we target. And that's still true to this date. Doesn't mean we don't support those other ones, right? But it's like, that is where our priority remains. And so that's always been true. And so we always focus on it from that angle. As you grow over time, obviously you get bigger and bigger customers. And we have some very large customers in the world. One of our largest is like Disney Plus, which is a tried and true enterprise account. It looks exactly like an enterprise account. Has enterprise needs. It's probably actually, they are less needy, I would say, than, I don't know, pick a finance company or an insurance company. Those are super needy accounts. We don't have a lot of like traditional looking accounts because even those kinds of companies like Disney, it's not like, I don't know what Disney has that's like legacy, but it's not some like old software stack or something. It's Disney Plus. It's a brand new technology thing they built. Like, I don't know who's public or not, but we have some banks. It's not like their old banking software. It's their mobile apps. It's their modern technology. It's their emerging new builds and stuff like that. And so it ends up being a little bit different for us. And they always come to us. We have no outbound that is effective, whatever. It's all inbound. It always has been. I don't want to say it always will be. I would love if we could find some way to grow it a little bit more organically. But so far, we have been ineffective. We are trying different things now. We'll see. We put up a billboard in Illinois. I think it was Illinois. It's wherever John Deere is, their headquarters. The CTO's name is on the billboard. And I'm like, maybe this will work. Not yet. And so we've not yet figured that out.
I saw that he was tagged, though.
Yeah, he did respond. He's definitely, he knows the billboard exists. It's on his commute to the office. I don't know. But like, we kind of like, we have the luxury that we are so good at what we do. And we've been able to dominate the market so well. And it's, you can't really like contend with us because we charge such a low price point and we have the economy of scale. It's really hard to make the technology cheaper than what we do. Like maybe there's a way, I highly doubt it. You would have to like lower the margins to such a degree that your business will not survive. And we will keep our prices at what they are forever. You know, we've actually not raised prices in like a decade or something almost, ignoring inflation. We have not touched them. I think we fixed something, but it didn't impact any customer, you know? And that's like, we have strong conviction in that in the company. And so we've done that so well that I'm like, well, the customers will eventually come. And we think about things where like, well, where are the next million developers and stuff? And I'm like, I have no idea where they are. Maybe they're not going to show up yet and we just got to wait for them. But we also think about things like, well, should we do, you know, you build a business, right? And we have this thing internally, and we stole this from Atlassian, I think, where we say we build for the Fortune 500,000 instead of the Fortune 500, which I think it's fun, but it's also like a more realistic way we think about it. But everybody can do that now because there's so many businesses in the world and they all actually have money to spend. And it's way more fun to build that way than like Fortune 500, which is just gonna be everybody super needy, super custom. And then you think about that and you're like, well, where do I get my next, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 customers? And I'm like, it's kind of hard. And you get to the long tail and you're like, okay, well, should we do FedRAMP or pick something really annoying, right? And I'm like, okay, how hard is FedRAMP? What do you got to do? I'm like, we got to build like an entirely new business to do FedRAMP. And I'm like, there can't be that many customers. Can we just never do that? And the answer is like, yeah, we can literally just never do that. Or China. We could just literally never operate in China. But like, some people don't think that way. And they're like, oh, no, we got to do this. We got to do this. And I'm like, no, you should do the thing that is the scale mass thing. Operate for the easy wins, not the hard wins. That's not every business, mind you. But in dev tools, I think it is. And so we've always been about mass market in every single decision, but every single decision has a consequence. So for example, you want mass market, the price point has to be accessible. That means you have to give up what is traditional enterprise business in the sense of where you charge, like charge for value, if you will, charge ludicrous price tags for no reason, which I think is, on one hand, it's kind of insane, but also it's probably deserving for some of those businesses. And so there's a consequence to everything, I guess is what I would say. But it's always just been that over and over. It's always like, where are the developers that we want to be our customers? Why are they not our customers? Can we remove those objections over and over and over? And then over time, we've gotten bigger and bigger customers to come inbound that have more and more annoying needs, is how I would describe them. And over time, we've accepted more of those customers. Early on, we just rejected them. But I will tell you, many customers came inbound early on. These are like the insurance companies, or there's a couple that probably public at this point, but it'd be like a, I don't know if this is actually the company, but it'd be like a Blue Cross Blue Shield or like a Best Buy or something. And they'd want like an RFC or one of these enterprise processes early on. I'm like, no, we just not do it because it wasn't a good spend of time. And now they're our customers. And so like, you know, it's like, it's a game of focus, I guess, is like, if you took one thing away from this, it's a game of focus and it's like, find the thing that works and just go after that thing until that thing no longer works, you know? And if that thing doesn't work, then find something that does, you know? And it's always that balance of like, how long do you spend on the thing that doesn't work? And how long do you spend on the thing that's working until, you know, it's like kind of, you've squeezed, I guess, all the juice out of it and you need to find the next thing that's going to work.
So if we summarize this all, Center is kind of like the household name. Everybody uses it, right? So engineers as champions kind of bring it into their organizations, and that's how organizations become your clients, because engineers...
Yeah, it's all bottoms up.
Engineers are using it. And engineers use it because it's convenient, it's cheap, it does the job well, it's just a great product. That's the thesis here.
Yeah. And what's wild is like, even with that, even with how we are the default, the best in class, we have so many shortcomings, even on the product that is 15 years old. They're so obvious because technology continues to change like outside of us. It's interesting because like most people at our stage would not focus on, say, YC. We are still aggro on focusing on YC and companies like that. And it's like, you kind of have to, because like you stop and the entire business will shift. Like most people would go up market and they'd be like, okay, now we got to focus on six-figure accounts. And we are like the polar opposite. We're like, no, it's all about the bottom, like the bottoms up, the top of the funnel. That is the focus. It's SMB, it's mid-market, it's that forever. Forever being like, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but it's like that focus never disappears, at least, you know, kind of thing. And it's super, super important for us, so.
And there are ways that you support that marketing through the open source pledge, right?
Source pledge. We do a big, like YC actually more specifically, and even in recent history, like we've spent a lot of time, like we actually launched like a new program there sub 6 months ago. We've already given out like 5 million in credits or something. And that's just like a totally new thing for us. We never did it before. And we're like, man, this is probably good. We can do this. We're big enough. And so we're just like trying new things and trying to figure it out. But I will say, it's the bigger you get, it's like there's so many moving parts and so many more customers. It gets harder and harder. And I think even remembering or realizing all these things are happening, it gets really hard. So
does it get harder when you're not a CEO or a CTO? Or
no, none of that changes. My job has not changed hardly at all from when I was CEO or CTO. And so like, I no longer really manage certain things, especially when I changed CEO. Like, I don't really manage anything on the investor side. To be fair, we also don't really raise money anymore because we don't need to. And so, like, but I don't interact with investors unless I want to now. I don't really do much on the exec hiring front, which is nice. I didn't want to do these things. But from a strategy point of view, I'm more or less involved the same way I always have been. From an engineering point of view, pretty similar. I'm more or less involved the way I always have been. I now just have a larger peer group, which is super valuable. And that's the great thing is, like, as you grow, you just get more people that are sort of, you're sort of growing. It's a total brain power, if you will, versus like, oh, now somebody's just doing this job so I can do less or something like that.
Actually, Paul Copplestone said the same thing. It gets easier when you hire great people and they can take part of the pie and, like, focus on that domain. So let's stay on the fundraising part just a tad. So from what I understand, you have been profitable since, like, you know,
not profitable, but we burn very, very little.
Mm-hmm. So if you're profitable as a dev tool startup, Sentry is Series E, but even smaller, let's say Series B. If you're profitable, does it still make sense to fundraise? Like, is there pressure to fundraise, or it really varies by case?
So Sentry 2015, we were profitable. It was myself, my co-founder, and we'd hired one person. We still had slim profit line. But then what? We had no more money. And so we couldn't hire anybody else. Did we need somebody else? Maybe. We couldn't do everything we wanted. So I think it just comes down to, like, what are you trying to do? And do you have enough money and what's the risk profile? And so I think you gotta run that math. I will say our last fundraise was 2022-23. I'm not sure we've spent any of that money. Did we need to raise that money? Maybe. It was ZERP. So sure, why not? It's cheap money. Might as well. You should raise when the money's cheap. You shouldn't raise when the money's not cheap. That's the rule of thumb. So I think it's fine that we raise the money. We make a ludicrous amount of money on the cash sweep every month, so it's fine. And we burn very little, but the burning is not good. It's not good to raise money and not spend it. So that is a thing, but it's not good to spend money that you don't need to spend either. So there's a balance to it, and I think you got to find that balance. But I don't think it has anything to do with profitability or not. So, like, people will often flex. It's like, we're profitable. We don't need to raise money. I'm like, that's cool. Who cares? Like, my goal is to build like a humongous business. I don't care what it takes to get there, because one day, like, we could be profitable very aggressively, very fast if we wanted to be. But the goal is not to be as profitable as quickly as possible. It doesn't matter. It's like an irrelevant fact, right? And so, like, my goal is, how do I become the biggest player in my market? Like, I have a singular North Star I focus on at Sentry. And so we have two core metrics that we drive internally. 250,000 teams. We call them companies or organizations, but 250,000 of those. And we're at paid. I don't know what our number is, but it's somewhere around 75,000. So it's like 150 total, but like 75 paid. So we're a long ways from this. This is not a short-term goal. 250,000. Those customers might not even exist yet today. So that's a long-term goal, and a billion in revenue. Those are our two targets that we talk about right now. I only care about that 250,000 customer goal. And so that's what I think about every day. That's all I'm trying to accomplish. Doesn't matter how I get there. If I get there, I've created something that, like, nobody touches ever of all time. And I've already basically, like, helped create something that is already, like, so significant that very few people in the world have ever achieved something at this level, right? And that's already cool. And it's like, so again, profitability, et cetera, it doesn't really matter. It's just like, how you sort of achieve the goal is mostly irrelevant, especially when you talk about, like, these, the internet is a thing. People like to bootstrap things, whatever. Doesn't matter. I would take the money any day of the week versus risking my own money or whatever, but it's got to be a business that can be big. And so there's a lot of variables that go into it, but venture is great. It's an unfair advantage if you can get venture funding. Not all businesses make sense to take it. It's great if you've got a lifestyle business. But I'll give you a good analogy of, like, Tailwind is a bootstrapped business. Right now, I bet. I don't know anything about their business. I don't know any of them personally. I bet right now they're like, ooh, what's business going to look like in 5 years? That's a very different beast than, like, we are building we are already a large enterprise company, right? And we're trying to build it into, like, a titan, right? And so we're just, it's a different thing. We live in entirely different worlds. And so, I don't know, it's really hard to contrast the things when you see these conversations. I'm like, I'm just not trying to accomplish the same thing as some of these other people. And so it just really depends on what you're after. There's always the right thing. But, like, we bootstrapped, we were profitable going into our Series A. We've never been profitable since. But then some years we burned like $2 million and we had $100 million in the bank. And so it's like, I don't know. It's
yeah. Like, yeah, that's interesting. Today was the news that Bungie has joined Anthropic. And, you know, people talk about, it's interesting, right? The ecosystem is shape-shifting. Something is happening. And what happened with Sentry 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is hardly repeatable as a case, right? Like it's, things really need to, you know, coincide for it to happen. So it's very unlikely. So if you were to give advice to somebody who is building today, what would you say are like a couple of things they should keep in mind as they build?
That's tough because I think even in like open source, it's wildly different. Like if you look at open source now, open source is dead. Like there is no new open source. It's all corporate funded. Like people might not like to hear it, but it's true. And is that a good thing? I don't know. Does it matter? I don't know. Like, and so it's complicated. It's probably not a great thing, but it's like, does it actually end up mattering in a long period of time? I'm not like religious about this, so I don't know. But it's like, so a lot of things are different. And I do think it's like, yeah, everything's like timing. So there's often very little you can learn from success, in my opinion. You can learn a lot from failures and things that you've experienced that are done wrong or you've done wrong. But I think you can learn about like how some people think about things and like, and what I find most interesting. So Sentry is like, we've done a lot of things that are counterculture and I love counterculture. And I'm a big fan of the Acquired podcast, which a lot of the stories you'll hear, cause they're like, they're just like the legends of business and stuff that they talk about. They're all counterculture. They're also all right time, right place. And they're also all like outlier humans, you know? And so I think I would just go to basics. It's like, everything is about like hard work. Yeah, some people get lucky. That's just life, whatever. You know, I would love to get lucky. We'd all love to get lucky. You know, if we do, cool, but you can't optimize around luck, right? So it's like work hard. I think there is like a network thing. If you can get to SF, despite what people would like to tell you, SF is unfair. Just do it. Who cares? Who cares about what the internet memes say? Like SF is like, it's like a network game, right? Like, especially if you want to like do the founding thing or the venture thing, like it is so unfair if you have access to SF. And so SF is really good. It's obviously a little bit better now elsewhere, but it's wildly different. But I think it's like work hard. I think the problem is like people struggle with how do you find the right thing? And I actually think the biggest mistake people make is starting a company versus just joining one. And so I worked at a lot of early stage companies. Sentry is the first company I started, but I worked at two gaming companies early life. Then I worked at Discuss. I worked at another company briefly and I worked at Dropbox. So Sentry is my sixth job and I started full-time. I think I was 30 years old. And I learned a lot from those experiences. And then you have like 20-year-olds starting companies. I'm like, you just don't know anything yet. You haven't experienced enough. You haven't seen everybody else mess it up yet. And so I would just say like, stop starting companies and go learn some stuff, but be ambitious. Stop asking for permission to do things, like take some ownership of things. But I think it's like, if you don't try really hard, like if you watch movies, like the, especially like all the stereotypes like Wall Street or like anything that's finance related, you see this and everybody's like hustling and trying really hard. And it's like, that is actually how it works. people do spend time, especially when you're young, cause you have less going on. I spent all my time working on my open source and stuff in the evenings, like Sentry early days, every evening, every weekend, because it was fun. Not because like I was pretending to hustle. I actually wanted to spend that time. I enjoyed it. It felt rewarding. At some point it felt rewarding because the business was growing and stuff. And so you just got to spend the time, get better. But I do think like find people you can learn from, find teams that are fun to be on, find, you know, challenges. You know, I'm sure like half the people in the city work on boring problems, like uninteresting companies. And it can be hard to get like on a really exciting team, but I guarantee you half the problems at say OpenAI are extraordinarily uninteresting and people should not seek those teams out. And so like you can go to small companies and still find these really interesting problems, you know? And all of my teams outside of Dropbox were like uninteresting tiny companies, but I worked on such interesting problems and that allowed me to do the cool open source stuff. It allowed me to operate at like an interesting scale of problems. And so I don't know, you kind of got to just be willing to do these things. And I don't know, it sounds like kind of like fluffy advice, but it's like, it's almost like just ignore the advice and like find interesting stuff to work on and don't over optimize. I didn't optimize for anything in early career. I just wanted to work on stuff. And I only left my job at Discuss because I was annoyed by some coworkers. And I only left Dropbox because like Sentry was like too much pressure. And the politics of Dropbox, it was big company growth mode. And And there was always like a forcing function that I was just like mad that I left, which is the right reason to leave for what it's worth. But it was never, I'm like, oh, I must have more money. I'm going to go like join this. And then 2 years later, I didn't have like a 5-year plan, you know? So I would like worry less about these kind of optimizations. Like everything works itself out in the end. So.
Nice. Speaking of Fluffy, we're approaching our final question and it's called Warm Fuzzy Question. And it goes like this. What makes you feel great about what you're doing today?
There's some things that are really fun. So I think about like what we're able to do. Like I love that we build a product that everybody, like a lot of people use and most people like it. But there's other things that we're able to accomplish that I actually like, it's really fun. I think about like, you know, things like the open source pledge. They're not really successful yet. Like we've managed to coerce some people and like we're probably like 6-7 million. Sentry alone gives almost $1 million a year. That's cool. Feels good. That helps some people. I think things like that are actually like pretty rewarding. I think personally, I'm trying to find more ways to like get involved in like programs and personally helping people, which is like rewarding. And so I think it's tough to say because I've not yet entirely figured out what like is like the almost like repeatable thing. Honestly, half the time, what's like really fun and rewarding for me is like building something interesting that people like. It's still the same thing that's always been there. So MCP was really fun because one, I felt like my skills finally were relevant again with this AI thing. Cause I'm like, oh, tech is changing again. I can finally build stuff. All of a sudden I am now relevant and I can teach people and do something. So that's been really fun. I do find it fun to like kind of give back. And it's interesting. I had this one heartwarming moment where like a kid, so there's this program called Hack Club, which is like high schoolers. And I'm a big, so when diversity in tech was like a big subject, like a decade ago or whatever, I'm like a big proponent of like, you can't fix the problem without fixing the funnel. Like you've got to like educate, like you got to develop people earlier in life, right? You can't like take, you know, somebody that's 40 years old out of a customer support job and pretend they're going to be successful, like out of a boot camp. We tried this, it was a failed program. And so I'm like, how do we get involved early? And so like early on, I'm like, okay, maybe I can help some of these. And I tried some different programs, but one of them was Hack Club. I just gave like a small cash gift, whatever. Didn't matter. But they gave laptops to people. And one of the kids like messaged me at one point. And he's like, I had this laptop forever, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like a nice random message. And I'm like, oh, this is so nice. Like it was like a high for like a weekend. And so like things like that are really, really nice. And so I'm constantly kind of looking for like, what are these like early stage, like high school to college programs I could get involved that could like push people in more of like what I would consider the good direction of life, which is more of like kind of like the hacker mentality. Like you can build things, you can get access to things because access is half the problem, right? And a lot of people don't have access, especially outside of like the US or outside of like Silicon Valley. So
maybe Nebraska can be a good camp for that, you know?
I thought about it, but I'm also like
very few programs.
Yeah, I'm like, I just don't want to go back there. It's like so uninteresting, but yeah.
Finally, I want to provide you a stage to invite people to use Sentry. I'm sure all of our listeners know what it is, but if they don't, how can they find it, when it is useful for them?
If you Google Sentry, we better be number one. There's an insurance company that owns the .com that one day we will acquire, but they're, I don't know, something like $1 billion in revenue, so we got a little ways to go. Sentry.io, when your app crashes, we tell you about it. That's the TLDR. We do a bunch of stuff these days, but you probably already use it. Works everywhere. It's mostly straightforward. If you need anything, I think I am Z-E-E-G, Zeeg. Don't ask. On Twitter, reach out, or X, sorry, X. I'm always happy to help. I'm a founder, not an executive, as I tell people, so super low-key, but yeah, I don't know. I never shill, so.
Thank you. Thank you for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs. We at Evil Martians transform growth stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open source products. If your developer tool needs help with product design, development, or SRE, visit evilmartians.com/devtools. See you in the next.